For those just tuning in, I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York.
First, we'll give you today's headlines.
Sheldon Silver, the former Democratic Speaker of New York State Assembly, was found guilty of federal corruption charges Friday, less than a year after his first conviction on the same charges was thrown out. Silver was convicted in 2015 of charges related to nearly $4 million he obtained in illicit payments in return for taking actions that benefited a cancer researcher at Columbia University and two real estate developers.
The Times Union reports that gun violence victim and former U.S. Representative Gabby Giffords is setting her sights on Representative John Faso. The political arm of Giffords, a group launched by the former Arizona Congresswoman to address gun violence in America, identified Faso as one of 12 candidates who are all Republican to defeat in November because of their stance on gun control. Faso has recently received nearly $9,000 in contributions from the NRA.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Citizens will be able to learn more information on how to help someone dealing with a suicidal thought at a Safe Talk class in Troy soon. The Troy Record reports on Tuesday, May 22nd, the Rensselaer County Mental Health Department and its Suicide Prevention Task Force will host a half-day alertness safe talk training that prepares anyone 15 or older, regardless of prior experience or training, to become a suicide alert helper. The free safe talk class will be hosted at St. John's Episcopal Church located at 146 First Street in Troy from 9 a.m. until noon.
The New York State Poor People's Campaign had a rally in civil disobedience at the state capitol in Albany on Monday. Similar events took place in 36 states. The new Poor People's Campaign comes 50 years after the original campaign led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was cut short by his assassination in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was supporting economic and racial justice for striking sanitation workers. The theme of Monday's rally was, quote, "Somebody's hurting our people. Child poverty, women, and people with disabilities," unquote.
Telsor reports that hundreds of people gathered in front of the U.S. Embassy in Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa, Saturday to protest Washington's decision to cancel the temporary protected status of TPS, which granted protection status to nearly 60,000 Honduran immigrants. The protest follows the U.S. announcement on May 4th in which the Trump administration effectively terminated the program for Hondurans. According to the Center for Immigration Studies, those under the TPS from Honduras have over 53,000 U.S.-born children. Some 300 protesters walked in front of the Palmarola at U.S. Military Air Base and Training Center to demand the departure of U.S. troops after the U.S. announced TPS cancellation for Hondurans.
As Puerto Rico continues to recover from two hurricanes and a series of blackouts, the FCC has proposed changes which would disconnect 369,000 customers from Lifeline, a federal program which connects poor people to telecommunication services. Lifeline was founded in 1985 during the Reagan administration and provides a small subsidy to assist in bill payments. Supporters of the program say that cutting funding before hurricane season could threaten thousands of lives in Puerto Rico.
At least 58 Palestinians have been shot dead and 2,700 wounded in Gaza by Israeli troops at protest over the opening of the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, which has infuriated Palestinians. They see it as a clear U.S. backing for Israeli rule over the whole city, whose eastern part of Palestinian lay claim to the top U.S. officials, including President Donald Trump's daughter and her husband, will attend the event. More than 60 Palestinians have been killed during the Great March of Return protests.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have something to say, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
Sexual assault is in the headlines every day. In New York State, a group of advocates is working to ensure that victims of sexual assault are able to seek justice, as we hear in our next segment.
I'm Corinne Carey, and I'm here with Jessica Shafroff, the chief strategist for the Coalition to Pass the Child Victims Act in New York State. The Child Victims Act would extend the statute of limitations for the reporting of child sexual abuse. The bill is designed to encourage more victims to come forward and seek justice for abuse that was never properly addressed, if it was ever addressed at all. It would also promote public safety as a way to expose abusers and the institutions that have hidden abuse for far too long. Good afternoon, Jessica. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Corinne.
I gave a brief summary of the Child Victims Act, but can you say a bit more about what the bill would do?
Sure. There are several different versions of the Child Victims Act in the legislature right now, but the bill that our coalition is supporting, and our coalition is comprised of survivors from across the state, survivors actually from across the country who were abused in New York, advocates, trauma experts, social workers, psychologists, medical professionals, a whole host of organizations who have all come together. There's over 150 of us now, are supporting a bill that would do essentially four things. One, it would prospectively extend the statute of limitations to bring civil charges against an abuser or an institution who was negligent in either reporting abuse or dealing with it in some way or covered it up. It would prospectively expand the criminal statute of limitation to bring abusers to justice. It would eliminate what we call the 90-day notice of claim to bring a claim against a public institution who has been negligent in reporting abuse. And it would also open up a one-year window where adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse could come forward and go to civil court.
And how long have advocates been trying to get this bill passed in Albany?
For far too long. This is year number 12. The bill has passed in the Assembly multiple times. The bill has never made it to the floor in the New York State Senate.
What are some of the arguments against passing the Child Victims Act?
You know, there are a lot of strawman arguments out there. We hear about memories fading and lack of witnesses and all of these kinds of things. But, the main opposition is to the window. The main opposition is coming from those who would actually be brought to court as defendants. They're the big institutions who have a history of covering up abuse, who have a history of not reporting abuse, keeping records of abuse, but doing nothing to actually protect children. So, it's folks like the Boy Scouts of America who kept records about pedophiles and their myths for decades and decades. It's the Catholic Diocese and some other folks who have histories of being negligent in reporting. And what they say is that, old cases shouldn't be brought to court now because it's impossible to defend against these cases when somebody might be dead or there's no recollection, there's no witnesses left. But there's nothing different about these cases than any other civil case that you would bring. The burden of proof is still on the plaintiff, which means the plaintiff has to prove their case. It doesn't hurt the defendant if there are no witnesses or no records or no memories. That hurts the plaintiff, right? So it's the same system that we have now in place for this. It's Another argument that we hear is that, the payouts would bring nonprofits or organizations that do good work to bankruptcy. And that just hasn't happened in any of the other states that have opened windows for adult survivors. Many institutions are covered by their insurance carriers for negligence. And beside that fact, we believe that if you were, if you did something that caused children to be harmed, then you should pay the price for it.
You mentioned other states. Are there other states that have extended the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse reporting?
Yeah, New York is actually at the very bottom of the ladder when it comes to statute of limitation reforms for these kinds of crimes. We're in the company of Mississippi and Alabama and Michigan, home of Larry Nassar. So,
can you remind our guests who Larry Nassar is?
Larry Nassar is the doctor for USA Gymnastics, who had over 250 plaintiffs come forward and accuse him of sexual assault in the world of gymnastics.
And many of those victims were barred by the statute of limitations from bringing him to court.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And, when you look at institutional knowledge, it's the perfect example of why we need to hold institutions accountable. There were over 150 complaints against Larry Nassar before the institution did anything. So until institutions feel like it's going to harm them more to hide abuse than to report abuse, then they're going to continue to protect their reputation and their bottom line.
You mentioned that one of the arguments against the bill is that, victims may have, their memory may be foggy. There may not be witnesses to come forward and speak for the defendants. Have any of the leading civil liberties or defense organizations come out strongly against this bill?
I haven't seen any of them come out. The only, the opposition that I know of is coming from, institutions who have been defendants in other states, who have long storied histories of covering up abuse, and from some insurance carriers. I haven't seen of any of those organizations opposing.
So we are speaking with Jessica Shafroth, the lead strategist for the Child Victims Act Coalition, on the Hudson Mohawk magazine. Jessica, what are some of the obstacles you face? It seems like this is a sympathetic piece of legislation, particularly in the Me Too era, in a time when many institutions are recognizing that they need to take responsibility. People are being held accountable. What are some of the obstacles you faced in getting this bill passed in 2018?
The main obstacle has been the New York State Senate. The Senate majority has not wanted to bring a bill forward. Last year, they even broke their own rules to report the bill out of committee without a vote. They've really tried to do everything possible to not really take a position on this issue. A bunch of them recently put out a bill. Just last week, so we finally have what appears to be, the majority of the Republican conference's position on this bill. However, that bill does nothing to hold institutions or abusers accountable. The bill would actually raid an account that is controlled by Manhattan DA Cy Vance that's being used by the DA to, amongst other things, help with the rape kit backlog, to pay out claims for folks who bring a claim in front of this, commission of folks who, it's not the normal judicial process, there'd be a special commission of folks who would hear cases and decide on cases, and the money would, none of the money would come from those who actually did the harm. So there would be taxpayer expense, there would be expense to other survivors, and it's not a bill that the vast majority of our coalition and the survivor community supports in any way.
So it looks like an attempt by some in the Republican conference in the Senate to pass a bill that looks like it does something and, in effect, not do what victims need in this case.
That's exactly right. And, I'm a survivor, so I can speak from the survivor experience. I know in with the hundreds of people that we deal with and the thousands of stories that we've heard from across the country, the number one thing that survivors are looking for is accountability. And there is no justice without accountability. And what this bill lacks is that essential element.
I've noticed that some advocacy organizations are starting to do more innovative methods of advocacy on this bill this year. For example, I saw a billboard when I was driving on 787, and I've heard people talking about the impact that the film Three Billboards has had. Is this something that you're finding an effective way of calling out lawmakers who haven't been responsive on this bill?
Yeah, I think a couple of years ago when I got involved in this measure, one of the first things I did with my client, Safe Horizon, is pull together the various organizations and survivors that we knew of who were all interested in the bill and try to coordinate an effort to pass meaningful legislation. And we've started a listserv and we share ideas, but, people do their own independent things as well. And there's various degrees of motivation. There's various degrees of anger. There's various degrees of coordination that goes on. But there are definitely a strong coalition and a more active coalition. And it's getting stronger and stronger every year. And a lot of folks are doing really amazing things, including touring around the state and meeting with PTAs and teachers and getting more medical professionals involved and speaking at Me Too events and Time's Up events and really growing exponentially. And the billboards have been effective. It's not something that I was part of putting together. I know the survivor who did do it, and, her heart is in the right place. And if you know anything about her story, but it's partially rooted in Troy. She was abused at the Emma Willard School in Troy by her teacher. And in response, the Emma Willard School put her on a bus and didn't tell her parents and gave the teacher a letter of recommendation to go on and abuse other children.
Jessica, thank you for sharing that story with us. What can our listeners do to help pass this bill in New York?
They can call their own state senator, particularly if your state senator is a Republican, and voice your support. You can reach out to me at 518-449-3359 and let me know if you're interested in joining an advocacy day. You can follow NYPassCVA on Twitter and New York Pass the Child Victims Act on Facebook for lots of different updates.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was WOOC correspondent Corina Carey speaking with victim rights advocate Jessica Scarfroth.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. In our next segment, WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce finishes his tour of new low-power FM stations in New Orleans at WXDR, Dolphin Radio at Delgado Community College. He spoke with longtime radio activist Bob Dunn.
I started this station 7 years ago in cooperation with a professor who was the newspaper advisor. I was teaching television and radio production, and the opportunity came up to start a radio station. And at first we went with a Part 15 unlicensed station, basically an AM station that operates legally under the FCC rules. 10th of a watt, and we covered a couple of miles with it, and we also started streaming on the internet. So the station had been here for a few years before the FCC reopened the low-power FM window, and when they did, I jumped on that.
So you had an existing station that was running on low-power AM, and you got a chance to go to low-power FM. What was your goal? What is the organizing principle behind Dolphin Radio?
Well, initially, the idea behind it was in part to provide a platform for students wanting to get their feet wet. I got my career started in college radio, like a lot of people. I mean, my first exposure to working in a radio station was at WTUL, the Tulane University station. So I've got a real soft spot for college radio. And I thought this would be a good opportunity. We had a program at the time having to do with broadcasting, and this would be a good chance for those students to have a venue, for the students who were studying journalism to have a venue, and also to give students an activity just for some fun, and also to wave the flag of the of Delgado Community College, which is just a really, really got a lot of different programs in a lot of different areas and has a very, very diverse student population. So we wanted to be a training ground. We wanted to be a playground. We wanted to be a place that would also afford voices to the voiceless, like all good community radio stations. We wanted to carry some programming that you wouldn't necessarily hear elsewhere.
And your background is broader than just radio. You teach mass communications. How did you get into that?
Okay, well, I teach mass communications now. I'm on the staff at Dillard University, which is a historically black college or university, well known in this area. And I went to work for them after my program was shut down here at Delgado Community College. But my background before that, I'm not an academic. I'm really a broadcaster, and so I've worked in television, in radio and film production, really almost since I was 17 or thereabouts, and I'm 60 years old now, so you do the arithmetic. So broadcasting is in my blood, radio particularly. I've been fascinated with radio since I was a kid, and despite all of the proclamations to the contrary, radio is not dead.
What is it about 100-watt FM radio that excites you after all these years in the field at the big stations and beyond?
It's the chance to do things a little bit different, to play music that maybe isn't heard elsewhere and maybe music that's heard everywhere else. But it's there's something magic about having a voice coming through a speaker. And it's not just somebody playing songs. It's not just Spotify. It's not just Pandora. But it's somebody keeping you company. It's somebody who is entertaining you. And to say where that magic is or where it comes from, I've been trying for decades to try to sort of get a handle on what that magic is. But it's there.
It's so interesting that with all the communications options that are out there now, the online services, just all the many ways that people can reach out to one another, that 100-watt FM radio stations have excited such passion in people. There's something about it as an organizing principle that seems to be really strong. Is there something that really resonates as far as this LPFM station and New Orleans as a unique culture and Delgado as a unique institution? Does that all come together in the radio station?
Delgado Community College and its population, its student population, as I said, is very, very diverse. It's very mixed. And so our programming reflects that mix. We have students from Vietnam. We've got students from the Middle East, white students, African-American students. And so our programming, I like to joke that it's everything from Led Zeppelin to Henry Mancini. It's not quite that drastic, but it almost is. So we play hip-hop and country, not necessarily at the same time. By the way, hip-hop country is an abomination. It's a genre. Look it up. So we're playing a little bit of everything depending upon the time of day, and it reflects the diversity of the student population, reflects the diversity of the city, and the wide range of folks here on campus.
What are the challenges of running an LPFM?
I always draw the analogy to the dog that's chasing the fire engine. And then what happens if one day that dog actually catches a fire engine? What the hell is it going to do with that fire engine? The challenges are, who knew? There are the technical challenges because equipment breaks, equipment stops working. Things that worked yesterday will not be working today necessarily because, you know, we're not all using top-of-the-line, latest, fancy, high-end equipment. A lot of things are begged and borrowed and hand-me-down stuff, and so we've got to nurse that along. There are personnel issues because, after all, the air staff is volunteers, and if a volunteer decides that he or she would much rather go to Jazz Fest than do his or her radio show, then that radio show is not going to happen, right? And if you get somebody who has their priorities a little bit different from those of the radio station, you may have some conflicts there. And what I mean by that is I tell the staff members, particularly the students, that there's sort of a hierarchy of importance. And the most important thing is the college itself. And we want to make sure that we are making people aware of what a great place Delgado Community College is. Then the second thing on the hierarchy is the radio station. Always want to be promoting the radio station, branding the radio station, letting people know we're out there. And the third thing is whatever you're about. So if you are if you're really into Bulgarian folk music and that is what makes you get up in the morning, that's great, but you can't make that your top priority at the expense of the other two. And how that manifests itself sometimes is with people who kind of fancy themselves entrepreneurs and promoters, and they've got a show that they want to promote, or they've got, I don't mean a radio show, I mean like a paying show. And we're a non-commercial station. So when, you know, I had a student DJ who was, in effect, running commercials for her friend's business. And to be able to monitor that stuff and keep tabs on it and manage it, I'll say, to put a stop to it, is a challenge in and of itself. Add to that, as I said, a lot of the equipment is hand-me-down, and sometimes we need to replace it. Where is that money going to come from? In this case, in this particular radio station, we get some funding from the Student Government Association. They bought the transmitter. We get some funding from our fundraising, or actually begging it, and a little bit of funding from underwriting, but it's not really enough to really run a radio station. So make it up with Band-Aids and chewing gum.
And what about audience? That's also a question that people ask about LPFM. Do you have any sense of that? Do you let that worry you?
I don't. I really don't, because we like to do remote broadcast. I'm a big fan of doing remotes in the community. And it's always very heartening when somebody comes up and says, Dolphin Radio, oh, I love you guys. And can that be quantified? No. Can it be turned into ratings? No. We get feedback from our Facebook page. We get feedback from our web page. And so I know that people are listening. I know people are out there. And I will look sometimes on our web stream, and it'll spike at times depending upon who's doing what show. I got a kind of an inkling when somebody from the Nielsen folks, the Nielsen Arbitron folks, said we were having a little bit of conflict because our former frequency, 98.9, was on the same frequency as the station in Franklinton, Louisiana. And the ratings people were getting confused because Franklinton's about 60, 70 miles away. And they were showing up in people's diaries and ratings for New Orleans. And we were showing up on the same frequency, and it was confusing them. And I said, well, what would it cost for us to get ratings? And they said, oh, you really can't afford it because you're averaging only a few thousand listeners a week. Oh, well, you just gave me the answer to my question. And whether they intended to do that as a kindness or that was just an accident, that was fine.
Great. Anything you want to add for our listeners in upstate New York?
Hi, upstate New York. How are you? Greetings from down here in the swamplands. Thanks for tuning in and supporting your community radio station. Without you, it just doesn't happen.
That was WXDR founder Bob Dunn speaking about one of the five new low-power community radio stations on the air now in New Orleans. For those just tuning in, I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. We'd love to hear from you. Text your thoughts and comments to 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a program on our station dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
A week ago, the Capital Region joined the world in celebrating May Day. Local labor activists gathered in Albany's Townsend Park to reflect on the holiday, and WOOC was there.
This is WOOC Roman Labor Talk Correspondent Willie Terry at the May Day March with the theme, No Border for Workers. I have as my guest for the show, Greg Giorgio of the Industrial Workers of the World, better known as IWW. And Greg is also a former radio host of the labor show that was on WRPI 91.5. Hello, Greg.
Hi, Willie. Nice to be with you.
On this segment, we're going to let you give us a perspective of this day, of this May Day or International Workers Day. So, Greg, take it away.
All right. I want to first say that it's a uniquely American holiday. That's the great misconception about May Day. It started here in this country, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. And, you know, the image that we have about May Day is really a false image that was dictated to us through the American media of tanks and rockets rolling through Red Square in Moscow. And, you know, it was always, May Day was always tainted as a communist thing, particularly in a time in our country when, you know, the anti-communist sentiment and political attitude was rampant. And so, you know, I want to say that people should be proud of their working history and their working class heritage that developed this uniquely American holiday. So how it happened originally was going back to a movement that started in the early 1880s. There had been some rumblings among organized workers in this country about having a unique forum to try to gain the eight-hour day. And it all came to a head after several years of organizing. And you have to understand that in American labor in the 1880s, if a million workers had gotten together to do something, which they did, that was a huge percentage of who could have been organized labor at that time. Because the population of the country, the way it was, and because the country was mostly rural, and most work was done in agriculture and not in industrial settings yet. And so it was a big advance for workers to have gotten together in the industrial sector to say that we need to fight for 8 hours of work, 8 hours of play, and 8 hours of what we will, or 8 hours of rest and what we will. And so that was sort of the marching theme. And a big part of the movement came together in Chicago. By 1886, it was clear that there was a groundswell of activity. Workers came together in Chicago. There were organizing meetings. And the lead group in Chicago was a group called the Haymarket Anarchists. Now, I want to clarify that There's another word that gets mixed up in confusion in our culture. Anarchists are people who believe that they're anti-authoritarian in the sense that they don't want anybody to be ruling over their own moral autonomy. I think the late IWW singer and self-identified anarchist Utah Phillips said it best when he said that anarchy is not a noun, but it's an adjective that describes the tension that exists between political authority and moral autonomy, especially in the area of combinations. And so, and what he meant by that was, you know, we didn't want corporate combinations and financial institutions to get together to some kind of influence over working people and people's autonomy.
So, Greg, how did the Industrial Workers of the World factor into May Day?
Well, in an indirect way, because our union didn't come together till 1905, nearly 20 years later. However, one of the Haymarket anarchists who was falsely accused of of a bomb that exploded in Haymarket Square in Chicago, Albert Parsons, a very interesting guy who actually fought for the Confederacy during the Civil War, but ended up being one of the lead American anarchists of that period. And he was arrested and eventually executed, along with a bunch of other men. And his wife, Lucy Parsons, was one of the founding members of the IWW. Lucy was a very interesting character who lived a long life and was always on the side of labor and always spoke against unreasonable authority of any kind, especially in the political spectrum. And so that's our union's connection to the Haymarket.
So what do you think is the future of May Day or of the workers' movement?
Well, I just want to say that we here in our area, in the Capital District of upstate New York, have a unique perspective on it because we're one of the areas in the country that has chosen to make May Day a holiday that we can celebrate beyond the American Labor Day holiday in September. This is really the origin of working class solidarity came out of that 8-hour movement of the Haymarket in the 1880s. And we've had the vision, people like Art Fleischner and John Flanders and people from the Solidarity Committee, people in my union, the IWW, have supported it. And we've had a very unique opportunity to not only learn the history and celebrate the day, but to try to spread the word that this is really our holiday to celebrate as working class people.
Okay, Greg. So the sun came out today.
Much appreciated.
Now, this is known as May Day, but there's also the acronym International Workers' Day, right?
Yes, and you know, it did spread. So workers around the world recognized that this grassroots movement that happened in our country was an important thing to note and to celebrate. And we have yet to catch up with the fervor and the enthusiasm and the organization that other workers have around the country in getting together and trying to rally for their causes on May Day. So we have a lot of work to do in this country to get where the rest of the world does on May Day.
Why do you think that the unions don't rally around May Day?
Well, I think it goes back to that that image that I spoke about at the outset of it being associated with Soviet Russia and communism. We had our own American holiday called Labor Day that the American Federation of Labor helped promote sometime after May Day had been established in this country, at least on somewhat of a recognized basis, not a wholly recognized basis, but Labor Day is substituted for it. But the American unions are more, the American AFL is more of a reform movement, and May Day came out of a more radical movement that wanted to transform how capital influenced workers' lives.
All right. Thank you, Greg, for that. Those words of wisdom and those historical words. And again, I don't know if you say Happy May Day or Workers of the World Unite, or how do you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of these kinds of things are common to be heard on May Day. Around the world, a lot of unions use May Day as a day to engage in some kind of work stoppage or industrial action. Some kind of strikes, too. So there are a lot of protests that happen on May Day. So I think it's a happy day, but it's also a day of action, and I think it's a day we should remember those who have fallen, too, because we do know that workers who struggle are very oftentimes are under the gun in terms of their very lives. So happy May Day to all.
Right, and the struggle continues. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
That was WOOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry talking to Greg Giorgio at last week's May Day celebration in Albany.
In our media segment, WOOC correspondent Aaron Pedinati sat down with Greg Himes of the blog Nippertown to dish on the goal of the blog and about the tracking of local events.
I'm Aaron Pednotti, and today I'm interviewing Greg Hames, who is one of the editors and writers for the online magazine Nippertown.com. Greg, thanks for coming in today. It's good to be talking to you.
Well, let's hope so.
Thanks, Aaron. All right. Well, we'll find out, right?
Yes, we will. Right.
So to start out, can you tell us about Nippertown.com? What is it, and what sort of topics does it cover?
Well, it's as you said, it's a online, I would say, arts and entertainment magazine. Sort of a little bit of everything on there. It's pretty hyper-local. Capital Region, Berkshires, Hudson Valley primarily.
And a little bit of Massachusetts too, right?
Yeah, so yeah. Berkshires, yeah, definitely. There's definitely some Berkshire stuff in there. I like to go over to Mass Mocha or Iron Horse or places like that, or in Pittsfield. There's a lot going on over there that I think the people in Capital Region tend to forget about. So as we try to plug a lot of that stuff, there's a lot of it starts off every day with a roundup of daily tips of events you can go and partake and check out. There's interviews, reviews, previews, there's a number of features that run sort of on a sort of weekly basis. Art beat, sort of visual arts roundup of what's going on. It's daily flashback. We do a little bit of funny history stuff and music and culture stuff. Wednesdays, we usually have the Hump Day Unusual Moment in tribute to Lynn Bramer, formerly of WQBK, who started that many, many years ago. Just some weird, odd music video usually. Thursdays we have the On This Date in Local 518 Concert History. And on Fridays, we, for the people who don't come to see Nippertown on a regular basis throughout the week, we always publish Hot Reads, which is a roundup of the top 12 most viewed stories of the week. So that if you're only tuning in one day a week, come on Friday afternoon and see what everybody else has been seeing.
So how and when did it get its start?
Well, this is almost exactly the 9th anniversary. Started on, we went live on May 21st, 9 years ago. And Metroland was still around at that point. And before we even had our first anniversary, we had placed, I think, third in their readers' poll of best local arts website. And then after we'd been there a year, we were number one. So it was like it grew really fast as far as audience recognition and acceptance. It started out just as I'd written for the Times Union for, I think, as a staff member about 19 years. And before that, Schenectady Gazette, and before that, Metroland, and before that, little fanzines around town. So I've been writing all this time, but at the Times Union, the news hall just kept shrinking, and there was not much room for arts and entertainment, and so I decided to leave there and just start up my own little thing. First time I really sort of took the reins myself, and my wife Sarah Ayers co-edit the monster, as we call it. It's we do about 8 posts a day during the week and 1 post a day on the weekends. So it's a lot of a lot of content providing going on.
Well, that relates to my next question, which is, can you tell us a bit about what goes into editing an online culture, arts, and entertainment magazine? First of all, what does the job involve in terms of the actual editing process?
Well, we have a, it's very much driven by community contributors. So we have a bunch of really excellent local writers and photographers who submit mostly reviews, some interviews, and some other odd pieces here and there, but they're mostly, I would say, concert reviews. So, and everybody has their own different style of writing, of course. So I try to maintain their voice, but then it's got to fit into the Nippertown format, which is, you know, got to recode everything, so, and put in all the links, and it's a time consuming effort. I think that's the really one of the biggest challenges about doing the editing for Nippertown is just how time intensive it is. But once, and you can't include everything. That's the other real challenge is deciding what to highlight, what to focus. Because there's so much going on in this town. People who think this is Smallbony, as they say, I think they just don't know where to look to find the things that would make them happy.
Right.
And that's what we try to do.
Yeah. And is the time intensiveness of it partly related to the fact that it's online? So you have a bunch of different people in a bunch of different places all submitting stuff at once, and you kind of have to process it all?
Yeah. A lot of the time intensive stuff has to do with just plain old doing online research. As far as not always getting information from, say, the venue or from the act, but going out and actively finding the information. I mean, there's any number of times when I think this morning I did. I posted a concert announcement before the venue sent out their concert announcement, just because I was looking at their website or I saw something mentioned on Facebook or something, and follow the path. And so that's what takes a lot of the time, is actually trolling around, doing the research, and but it is also trying to balance. I don't want to have two or three jazz reviews all on the same day. I want to have a folk review and a heavy metal review and a theater review, and sort of spread them out a bit so that things are a little more balanced art-wise.
Right. So time is the challenge. Can you tell us a little bit about the rewards of this editing process?
Well, I mean, I really think the best reward of about Nippertown is that it's immediate. Having spent time writing for monthlies and weeklies and dailies, there's always a time lag, and now it's like immediate. Like I said, I can post something before the venue even announces that it's happening. And that's, again, that's having the time to do that, though, to be there when you find it and get it immediately online. The other thing about, the other real reward about doing Nippertown is going to a show and, having somebody come up to you and say, oh, thank you, Nippertown. If I hadn't seen this on Nippertown, I never would have known about this. And it was great. We tried to search out some of the, more what I would call interesting and oddball things rather than,
right.
I mean, if it comes down to spotlighting some, say, trumpet and drum duo at the Sanctuary or David Matthews at SPAC, I think David Matthews is not going to make the cut. So,
especially after like 40 million years of him.
Yes, there's that too. I've written about music and art for a long time, and at this point, I'm really looking for the more interesting, more adventurous stuff, the unusual.
So, last question. When I looked at the About Nippertown section on the website, a part of this description read as follows. Why Nippertown? Question mark. We like dogs. We like music. We especially like large outdoor sculptures of dogs that look like they're listening to music. This was posted below a picture of a dog lying on a black and white tile floor with a small porcelain sculpture of another dog sitting near its face, seemingly looking into its eyes. Scrolling back through the articles on the site, I discovered that there's a semi-recurrent motif of dog pictures.
Oh, yeah.
So can you comment on the canine component of Nippertown's content?
Well, yeah, we're dog people, you know. It's
just comes down to that.
Actually, my wife wrote that beautiful little two sentences about dogs and sculptures and music. When we were starting, before we'd started Nippertown, actually, we were thinking about doing something and trying to come up with a name that would be local, but not, you know, sort of specific. I didn't want to call it the Albany something or the Troy something.
Right.
And we decided that the two most, you know, distinctive landmarks were the Egg and Nipper. And we couldn't really do the Egg because that's a venue. We wanted to do something that was a little more open-ended.
Right.
And so we decided
on Nipper. The Egg would be cliche at this point.
Well, yeah. To anybody local, certainly, yeah. But Nipper was, you know, so we did a couple of searches to see what domain names were available. Mm-hmm. And Nippertown was open. And we said, yeah, let's Nippertown. That's... You know, we can make that as broad and a geographic area as we want it to be. Mm-hmm. So we picked Nippertown, and the photo I think you're talking about I think is our dog Shelby with a little miniature Nipper by his nose. We started off with a two dog canine advisory board. We lost Kale, but Shelby is carrying on, and we try to every week and end the week with a sort of thank you called "It's the Weekend," and at the top of that column is a photo of Shelby, and as to why, it's because it makes us happy.
Oh, well, that's a good reason, and Nippertown definitely works a lot better than Eggtown too. So,
yeah. Well, it probably would have been Eggville, or you know.
Sounds like it's time to bring a little puppy onto the advisory board.
Yes. But, well, we have been discussing that, yeah. But
well, Greg, thanks very much for this interview. It was very nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Aaron. Yeah.
That was Greg Himes of Nippertown speaking with WOOC correspondent Aaron Pegnati.
Unfortunately, we are not able to be joined today by Stanley Hadsel from Market Block Books in Troy. Stanley will be on next week, though, as he is every week, to inspire us to read.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Chris Scully. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through the Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or just want to tell us how great your day has been, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thank you for tuning in.